Okay, welcome to lecture two. And so this is the lecture where I'm going to give you enough information for you to begin to write CUDA programs. And one of the criteria that people always cite about a new parallel programming language is whatever you do, you need to make sure that people can learn all the basics to write a simple program in one lecture, okay? And the definition of one lecture should be no more than 90 minutes. And you can stretch one lecture into like 1,000 hours, right? The people get really tired at the end of the lecture. So, you know, we actually take this very seriously. So over the years, we always insist that we can, you know, no matter what we do with these parallel programming languages, we need to be able to explain enough of the basics so that people can do a simple program in just, you know, after one lecture. And this particular lecture is going to also build on some of these previous experiences that you're going to have, namely C programming language. So if you're not very familiar with C programming, if you have never done this piece of C code in the past, I also sent you a 190 website, a URL before the class, so that you can take a quick look at the textbook as well as some of the material, so that at least you get familiar with some basic C syntax. And there's also the other end. Some of you actually came with some background in GPGPU programming. And any of you have done GPGPU programming in the past? So this is the reason why I need to make sure that I also talk about some historical aspects to make sure that I put your kind of mindset into the right framework. So for those of you who have done GPGPU programming, this was a movement that was that took place about 7-8 years ago, when people started to realize that these GPU hardware are getting to the point where they're actually having very good floating point throughput and a lot of memory bandwidth. So at that point, all these GPUs were strictly programmed through what we call the graphics API, application programming interfaces. So basically, if you want to use GPUs, you have to make some function calls into the graphics libraries, okay? And these graphics libraries can do all kinds of rendering and all kinds of, transformation kind of things for you. So if you want to do a physics calculation, and as long as you figure out how to map your physics function into a graphics rendering function, and you pretend that you're calling a graphics rendering function, and essentially camouflage all your physics properties into something that can be represented in the graphics mode, then you can be in business. And so essentially people use this technique to accelerate critical path applications. And oftentimes people would do these take the data parallel portion of these applications, and so that the sections that handle large data arrays, and even today when you look at CUDA, the most effective applications still use large arrays. Okay, so in that sense, it's still very similar. And streaming throughput. If you need to stream a large amount of data through the hardware, do some kind of transformation on a large data set, that usually gets you, these GPUs usually get you pretty good performance. And oftentimes you want to have applications where the same operation is done on a large amount of data. Okay? And if you have a lot of large amount of repeated operations, you can use same instructions. Single instruction, multiple data, SIMD mode, then you're usually in pretty good luck with GPUs. And of course, these hardware have very low latency, in the order of about 3 to 4 clock cycles for floating point operation. So just compared to the typical CPUs, the lower latency floating operations, not only in multiply and division, but also sine, cosine, exponential functions, these things are all very low latency on the GPU for graphics reasons, right? So, if you need to use these kind of things, the GPUs tend to give you pretty good performance. So if you go to look at gpgpu.org, you will see a whole bunch of these applications. And many of them are, you know, game physics, and you know, image processing, you know, physics modeling, computational engineering, like computational fluid dynamics, matrix algebra, convolution, correlation, you know, all that stuff, you know, missile target identification, all these things. So this is, you know, kind of an interesting historical foundation for, you know, CUDA programming today. But there's a very big difference.
And this is the difference that, you know, I need to make sure you understand for those of you who have done GPGB programming before we talk about CUDA.
Well, when you program in the old GPGPU interface, you know, you really need to call the graphics APIs. You really need to go through either OpenMP or you know what, DirectX kind of interface.
OpenGL.
What did I say?
OpenMP.
Oh, yes. Thank you, John. So OpenGL, Open Graphics Language, you know what? So the address, there are several things about these, you know what, APIs. Typically, what happens in these APIs is that the yellow box here represents a piece of code, okay, that you're going to invoke. And that piece of code has to be written as what we call a shader function. That is, these functions are written to paint some color, okay, to paint something into a pixel. So everything in that world is represented as a pixel, okay? And you know, this is not new, right? You know what we always say, if what you have is a hammer, everything looks like a what? Nail, right? If you know, if what you have is a graphics processor, everything looks like a pixel, right? So you need to make sure that, you know, your computation data can be somehow treated as a pixel. And you write a piece of code that essentially paints color onto a pixel, okay? And or that piece of code is going to be used on many, many pixels. So by the end of the computation, you get your result. So how do you paint color onto the pixel? You use something called texture. So in graphics, you have a piece of, you know, essentially a little picture, right? A texture, you know, picture that you want to paint on a set of pixels so that it will look like that texture, right? So, you know what? If you want to do something like, well, I want to calculate all the forces that is, you know, asserted on a particle, then you represent that particle as a pixel. And then you take the information of all these other particles and package them into a texture, and then you paint the forces onto that particle, right? And now you're beginning to see my point. The point is, it's actually painful, okay? You need to, you know, if you are calculating something like a electrical potential in space grid, it's not that bad, okay? You can actually just, you know, say, okay, for each space of the grid, let's get particle information into the texture and then paint it onto that point, right? So you can have all the neighbors to paint some kind of influence on that point, and you might be done with it. But if you have a particle that needs to move around, and you're trying to use this code to actually, you know, update the the information on that pixel, then you run into serious problem, because when you move these things around, you may actually have to do addressing mode calculation. And this particular type of computation does not allow you to randomly access your input data and output data in using the traditional addressing mode. So you need to really fix your input by feeding that input into the input register. And then you need to generate an output, and you need to write that into an output register. There's not a model where you have a huge data space and you can calculate where you want in that space, and then you can calculate what you want to write to in that space. It's really, you need to prior extract the data into the input registers, and then you need to put data into the output register, and eventually you do some kind of shoveling at the end to figure out where the data actually goes into the addressing space. So that's why, you know, these things all become a lot of limitation in terms of, you know, programming convenience and so on. And as history showed, that these constraints eventually weigh down the people's enthusiasm in terms of programming these things. And in fact, about 5-6 years ago, quite a few of my friends were working on GPGPU programming. And I started to look at some of the GPGPU programming myself. And after looking through that, I say, who in the world would want to do programming in this kind of paradigm? It's like punishing yourself, right? So I decided not to pursue this kind of work 5-6 years ago, until
2 years ago, when NVIDIA started to work on CUDA,
and they actually learned a great deal from the GPGPU programming paradigm. And this is something that I would like to encourage all the grad students here to think about. In many ways, when you build something that other people can use, when you build something useful, oftentimes it's not going to be your first piece of work. Okay, if you're trying to do something that is eventually going to make some impact, oftentimes you have to give it multiple tries, and you really need to learn from each try, and you really need to learn carefully and listen carefully about why other people have problems with your work, right? And eventually you will succeed. And in fact, my friends, used to do this all the time. He actually builds a boat every spring, okay? And then he will sail on the Wisconsin lake, and then through the summer, he will, learn all kinds of things about how that boat operates. He will take, friends on the sail and so on. And then in fall, he will chop up the boat and use it as firewood. And next spring, he will build another boat. And through the years, he has been building better and better and better boats. Okay. And some of his designs actually got into design winning, things. And this is a computer architect. Okay. So you can get really, really good at these things by building things, having people to use it and learn about it. So CUDA is sort of the result of that that learning experience. And this the reason why it's called CUDA is because it's a cool name. Okay, so then they figure out let's figure out the acronym for it. So it's kind of Compute Unified Device Architecture. And if you listen to David Kirk's keynote, and I think some of you already did, right? CUDA in Polish actually means what? You got it. Miracle. Okay, so it's a coincidence. It's pure coincidence. They didn't know about it until summer this year. And in fact, when one of my immediate friends went to Poland and saw the Pope's talk advertisement, and then there's a big CUDA sign on it, and then people say, "Oh, Pope actually does CUDA programming," mm-hmm. And the local people say, "You idiot! CUDA means miracle in Polish." So, it's designed to be a general programming model. The user actually will start with a piece of CPU program. Okay, it's in traditional C++ programming mode. But then at some point, the programmer can kick off batches of threads. Okay, a whole bunch of these parallel execution threads, and on the GPU. So the GPU is really just a dedicated, super threaded, compute intensive piece of hardware that will crank through these threads very, very quickly. So it's not a graphics engine that is painting something onto a lot of pixels, but rather it's an engine that allows a huge number of activities simultaneously going on, and these activities all have capability to randomly access memory, okay? So it becomes a much more general purpose model. And then, in addition to that, these guys also built what we call the targeted software stack. And this is really from NVIDIA's perspective, so let me translate that for you. Some of the slides, by the way, are actually produced. I didn't produce all the slides. I produced quite a few of those slides, but I have to acknowledge at this point that a lot of the slides were actually contributed by the NVIDIA technical people, and they're what they call the kitchen people. So there's actually a lot of work from various people. It's not just David Kirk and myself. So So, you know what, essentially from NVIDIA's perspective, their product line has been what? Graphics, right? So, you know what, all their product focus is on building the best possible graphics drivers, building the best possible graphics hardware, right? And you know what, making sure that the games and so on all work well. So if you look at it from their perspective, a natural way of building CUDA is to actually just try to reuse the graphics drivers to, let's say, transfer data between the CPU and the GPU, right? And then repatch things a little bit so that you can do some computing on it. So what they're saying here is that instead of reusing the graphics driver, they actually bother to, you know, hire people and write the compute drivers. And these drivers do not need to worry about the specific characteristics of graphics data transfer, and they don't need to satisfy the constraints of graphics mode so that they can actually maximize, for example, throughput versus response time, so that they can, you know, because they don't no longer need to deal with some of the real-time constraints, they can actually achieve higher throughput in these, you know, transfers. So for those of you who are system-oriented, you know, this is actually a big deal in the sense that, you know what, they're willing to, you know, invest resources to make sure that the compute driver end can actually, you know, do all the right things as far as, you know, data transfer and so on for computing is concerned. And they built, you know, separate language tools and you know, debugging tools, and we'll actually go into some of that you know, very soon. So as you know, if you look a little bit more into the driver, the most important part of the driver is really to load computations, programs, and data into the GPU. And this, as I mentioned, this standalone driver is optimized for computation. The interface is really designed for compute. And I'm going to show you a couple of slides to show you what that really means. And then data sharing with OpenGL buffer objects. So this is actually one of the cute features that you know, we're eventually going to come back to. What this one means is that if you have a separate compute driver, you can run the risk of totally isolating the graphics part, the graphics, you know, activities from the compute activity. So for example, if you want to compute something, okay, let's say if we want to compute a electrical potential map, right, in a molecular you know, structure, then you want to animate it or you want to, you know, visualize it, right? So if you have a total separation of the two, you may have to do the computation and then move the data back into the CPU. And then you call the graphics interface and move the data into the GPU for, you know, graphics display, right? So by enabling punching through a little hole between those two, you can actually leave the data on the local memory of the graphics board and then directly invoke the graphics mode to, you know, render the data. So this gives you a lot better, you know what, collaboration between the compute end and the animation end. Okay. So also, because of the you know, the separate driver, you can actually have, you know, achieve, as I mentioned, you know, the highest possible throughput, because you no longer have to worry about some of the interactive response time and interoperability kind of thing with graphics mode during the transfer. And you know what, you have explicit GPU memory management. And this is kind of a, you know what, it's viewed as, you know, both a kind of a merit and an evil, in the sense that, you know what, you have a lot of control into how you move data between the CPU and the GPU. So control in many ways can get you a very good guaranteed way of getting the performance you want. It's very predictable in that sense. However, it also involves a lot of tedious programming effort. So that's why we're working with NVIDIA at this point to, you know, to build on this, you know, basic model, but, you know, build additional higher level tools to allow programmers to optionally relinquish some of the control, but, you know, achieve more flexibility and also to reduce the amount of tedious programming work. So by the time I have gone through the first lecture, you should be able to have at least a glimpse into some of the tedious natures of the data transfer, and then you will gradually start to appreciate the value of some of these tools that will be coming your way in the future. I'm not going to say a lot of things about hardware at this point, and we're actually going to have one lecture on this kind of stuff, okay, later on during the semester. But this is actually something about how the GPU and the CPU relate to each other in a PC. And typically what you see from your end is that you have a PC box, okay? And the PC box, can accommodate these PCI boards, right? So you can go buy a graphics board and something like GTX, something, right? 8800. And then you can insert that, open up the PC box and insert that board into one or two of those PCI slots. And that gives you the GPU capability in that box. And it turns out that it's not always the case. If you have a laptop, it may have already come with a small GPU, and which only contains something like two of the streaming multiprocessors rather than the 16 we showed you last time. Or in some cases, you may buy a Tesla box. And that Tesla box is going to have four GPUs in that box. But there is a little connector that you can use to connect into one of the PCI slots. And that gives you the GPU. However, really what happens inside the motherboard is that you're going to have what we call the core logic chip, okay, sitting on that board. And that core logic chip used to be called chipset, by the way. And the core logic chip will connect the CPU on the top here with the GPU, as well as all these memory, the CPU memory banks and all the I/O devices. So this particular, this particular chip is going to give you about 8 gigabytes per second for the generation that you'll be using now. And it also connects the Intel processors and connect what they call the front side bus into the memory, okay, with approximately the same level of bandwidth, also about 8.4 gigabytes per second. So in many ways, even though the transfer of data, okay, you can argue that the transfer of data from the CPU memory, okay, on the right-hand side into the GPU can be a bottleneck in your application. But if you really think about it, if the data is in the CPU memory, the amount of bandwidth that you need you're going to use to transfer into the GPU is not all that different than the amount of bandwidth you have available transferring the data into the CPU for processing. So this is the reason why I usually talk in front, because there are some of these questions that you're going to ask unless you have a little bit of these basic model in mind. That typically what happens is the CPU will be operating with cache, and then you will have very high amount of bandwidth, hopefully a lot of bandwidth moving a large amount of data between the CPU and the memory. And for those of you who are familiar with high-end scientific computing, you will realize that the cache memory on the CPU typically don't do a whole lot of good for these large data set applications. So fundamentally, the CPU can be limited by the bandwidth that can be used to transfer data between the memory and the CPU. So here you have a GPU that is the same situation, and the GPU will need to be able to get data in and out of the GPU into and from and back to the CPU memory, and that's going to be the 8 gigabytes per second bandwidth. In fact, it's a little bit worse than that because it's 4 gigabytes uplink and 4 gigabytes downlink. Okay, so you can simultaneously do load and store. So someone like John Stone would tell you, he does this all the time. He will actually have a computation going, and he will have the GPU to be transferring input data and output data at the same time, so that you can actually achieve that high level of bandwidth. But these are things that you're going to have to learn later on.
Okay.
So let's kind of ease ourselves into the, you know, into the CUDA model in terms of programming. So you know, just a little bit more about the general paradigm of, you know, what GPU programming, GPU computing means. So in the A series, which is based on the basic G80 design, you know, the G80 core design. These GPUs deliver between 25 and 200 plus gigaflops, you know, essentially compiled C applications. And you will see lots and lots of variations of GPUs today. Okay, as I mentioned, you can, you may well have a laptop that comes with a small GPU. And, you know, you may, you know, have been using a desktop that has a single GPU card. You may be using a CUDOFlex box that has two GPUs in there, and then you may have a Tesla box that has four GPUs in there. Okay, so all these things actually execute exactly the same programs. This is actually an amazing part. They actually manage to be able to execute exactly the same binary. And I'm going to go back to this point again and again and show you how they achieve this kind of binary compatibility across such a wide range of, you know, implementations. But you do pay a penalty, you do pay a price for that, okay? And you're gonna see that in CUDA programming. And the GPU parallelism at this point is roughly doubling about every year. So, you know what, the amount of parallelism that is available is, you know what, has been increasing quite dramatically, you know, over time. So that's why whatever program that you write, you know what, it is very important for NVIDIA to be able to execute that exact same program on the next generations of hardware. Right? It doesn't mean that you cannot get better performance by rewriting the program, but you should be able to get as good or better performance by executing exactly the same binary. Right? The programming model really is designed to scale transparently, and you do pay a price for that, and it's, you know, essentially programmable in C with CUDA tools. And I'm going to show you what are the extensions to C that they make to, you know, to enable CUDA programming. And it's really fundamentally a multi-threaded single program multiple data SPMD model. And for those of you who are, you know, who come from the scientific community, most of the high-end science computing have been done with, you know, essentially MPI, the message passing interface with SPMD model. So, you know, that's why, you know, they chose this particular model. The same piece of code is going to be operating on various different parts of the data structure, but they're all essentially doing the same thing. And, you know, this is a familiar model for a lot of the people who have been doing parallel programming, and, you know, that's going to be the
fundamental model for you know, CUDA programs.
So we're going to go through the CUDA programming model. You know, we're going to talk about basic concepts and data types, and then we're going to go into the API, application programming interface, some important functions that you'll be using from day one, and then simple examples. You know, we'll go through a simple matrix multiplication example to show you how you can transform a C program, a sequential C program, into a parallel CUDA program. And, you know, you would realize at the end that there's some tedious work, but in the end, you'll realize that it's not all that different from your original C program. And the performance features will be covered
later.
So this slide is, has been, I think John Nichols at NVIDIA has been using this slide in some of his talks. So, you know, I kind of like the slide, so I stole that from him. And you know what, it's CUDA is really C programming. And you know what, it's an integrated, what we call an integrated host and device code. You start from the concept where you execute your entire application on your CPU. Okay, that CPU is the host. So before you do anything, you should have a piece of code that is, you know, executed on the CPU alone, and we call this a original host code. And you know what, we want to move the highly parallel parts into a device, SPMD kernel code. And so, you know what, the basic execution model is, you will execute an application, let's say you start your application, you typically will have some, a bunch of these, you know, housekeeping, you know, some initialization, some of these things, and oftentimes they don't take a lot of time, but they may take a lot of code, right? So those things, you can keep them on the CPU, okay? And then you, you know, as soon as you hit a situation where you need to do a huge matrix multiplication or a huge convolution or a huge something, you know, some kind of a differential equation solver, you launch a parallel kernel function. And that parallel kernel function will invoke thousands of threads. And after it's done, you will transfer the data back into CPU. You will transfer data from CPU memory to the device to do all this work, and then you will transfer things back, and then you will continue to execute on the CPU until you hit the next, you know, parallel section. This is a very, very simple-minded way of looking at CUDA execution. If you look at most of the high-performance CUDA code, oftentimes the sequential part is actually overlapped with the parallel part. So oftentimes, you will be executing in parallel, you know, on the GPU, while the CPU will be doing some sequential work behind the scenes, preparing for the next one, or actually picking up after the previous one, okay? So, you know what, but at the beginning, you're more than welcome to think about it, you know, in this way, so that you can at least get a lot of the basics right. And then you can start to think about how to actually, you know, overlap the CPU and the GPU operations. So going back to the devices, you know, so you know, essentially you can think about devices as heavy-duty, high-throughput, low-latency compute function units. And so a compute device in CUDA is really a coprocessor to the CPU, and the CPU is called the host. Okay? And you know, these devices actually has its own. Have their own DRAMs, and they're called device memory. In the current generation, the device memory range from about 1 gig to about 4 gig. Okay, so it's not substantial amount of it's actually substantial amount of memory in what that you can hold data, but they're still going to be smaller than the GPU, the CPU memory. The higher end CPU boxes now have a lot more than 4 gig of memory. So, you know what, this is something that you need to keep in mind. You know, there's substantial amount of device memory, but oftentimes it's not enough to hold the entire data structure. It runs on the threads. You know what, it runs many, many threads in parallel, okay? And, you know, it typically is a GPU, but this is changing. If you strictly follow the model where the host is a CPU, and the device is a GPU, then you may run into a bad situation where, let's say, if your user uses a GPU that does not support CUDA, or if the user has a machine that doesn't really have a GPU, you know, kind of thing, then your program doesn't work, right? And so, you know, we realized this a while back. And we have one of our own, John Stratton, to develop a piece of tool called mCUDA that can translate the CUDA kernel code, the device code, into multi-core CPU code. So you only need to write your CUDA kernel once, the device code once, but then there are tools for you to either execute that code on the GPU or actually take advantage of the multi-core CPUs, and you can be, you know, you can execute the same CUDA source code on both arrangements. So this allows you not to have to write your code twice, once for the CPU, once for the GPU, when you try to use the devices. So in this sense, we're beginning to see more and more emphasis on also treating multiple cores in the CPU chips as device. Okay, you can actually use the other ports in the CPU as the device. The data parallel portions of an application are expressed as device kernel functions, and we're going to see exactly how you can do it in the next few slides. There are some important differences, okay, that you need to, you know, you need to recognize right from day one between the GPU and the CPU threads. The GPU threads are very, very lightweight. It takes a very small amount of time to create these threads. Okay? You can create thousands of threads in a matter of very small number of clock cycles. The reason is all these things are done in hardware. Okay? There's no thread building block. There's no, OpenMP thread management software in there. It's all done essentially by hardware mechanism. I'm going to show you that slide. And then the GPU really needs thousands of threads to for full efficiency. If you cannot generate thousands of threads on the, you know, on the GPU, you will be underutilizing that hardware. Whereas if you're using a multi-core CPU, you can do very well by generating 8-16 threads today. Okay, you can do very, very well. So you know what? That's a very basic difference that you need to, you know, you need to worry about. In fact, if you try to generate thousands and thousands of threads on the CPU today, you can actually swamp the machine and get really bad performance. And you can really essentially load down the software, you know, the runtime software management for the thread management, and really destroy your performance by generating, you know, thousands of lightweight threads. So this is a, you know, the next slide is really a kind of a picture that shows how the GPU CUDA mode is built, sort of based on the graphics engine. So you know what, if you look at the G80 internals, if you look at the graphics interface, what happens is the CPU will be issuing these graphics commands, okay, into the GPU. So what are the graphics commands? You have vertex processing, okay, you have pixel processing, and you also have, you know, geometric, you know, transformation processing, and all these are essentially function calls, right, into the OpenGL library. And these, you know, function calls actually gets, you know, received by the input assembler, and then it will be fed into the vertex thread issue or the geometric thread issue or the pixel thread issue. So the CPU is going to say, handle all these triangles for me, okay? And then the GPU hardware is going to translate that into, oh, I'm going to generate hundreds of threads. And these threads are going to be handled, each thread will be handled one of the triangles, okay? So that translation process is actually done by the interface. So the internal of the graphics processing unit is already a fairly generic thread execution engine, but there is a fairly sophisticated piece of hardware interface that translates those graphics commands into lots and lots of threads to utilize that engine. Okay, does that make sense? So in many ways, you can also have simultaneous vertex and geographics and pixel processing on, you know, various parts of that of your application, and they can actually be load balanced by all issuing some threads into the engine. So that if you have an application where you have mostly vertex processing, but very few of these, you can, you know, utilize the entire engine. And if you have another application that uses mostly pixel processing but very little vertex processing, you can also make use of the entire engine. So that's how they balance the load from compared to the previous generation of graphics pipeline. For those of you who are, you know, familiar with the graphics pipelines in the past, yes.
So in CUDA creates threads, which of these issue queues does it use?
Great question. So which issue queue does CUDA processing use? None of them. Okay, so essentially they build a new interface next to all that stuff. Okay, but whenever you're in the CUDA mode, all those things are turned off, truly turned off. Okay,
And then you just have a host that issue, the host itself is going to issue the multi-thread generation. So it's going to essentially come and say, generate this number of threads with this structure. So the host command now replaces those issue queues. Does that make sense? And so the queue is really just in terms of threads now. And we're going to talk about the thread organization when the host issues those commands. It's very concise. So then these threads will be parceled out to these 16 SMPs for the GAD chip. And then for G280, as mentioned last time, there are 30 of these. So they will just execute all those threads. There are a few subtleties that I did not talk about. For example, if you look at the previous slide, you will see things like L1 cache, TF, and L2 cache, and frame buffer, and all that stuff. And they actually get recommissioned by the hardware interface in the CUDA mode into shared memory, parallel data cache, into texture memory, and into the low score, what we call the coalescing units. So all these things get used. The same hardware resources are actually redefined in terms of their functionality and their roles, so that they are in the CUDA mode. So this is really a new interface. And it does not necessarily require a huge amount of chip space, but it is something that requires major design effort to get that kind of stuff right. So let's go into, that's kind of the mental model that you need to keep when it comes between the GPU, the graphics mode and the CUDA mode. Now let's go a little bit deeper into the programming end. CUDA is really an extended C. And the extension is made with five categories of changes to the language. And the first change is what we call the deco specs, declarations. Okay? It added a few keywords that you can place in front of your typical declarations, data declarations, or function declarations. So for example, if you have a data that you used to call a floating point data type filter array, and you want this piece of data to reside in the device memory, okay? You want to declare that piece of data in the device memory, then you can have __ __device__. There are two underscores, okay? So that this piece of data is now on the device memory. And you can declare something as global. And this global, I'm going to come back to this point, and this global is actually meant for function declaration. And this is where the kernel function will be declared. So you can define something as a kernel function, and that's the beginning part of your parallel execution. Okay, that's how you start the parallel execution. And you can have shared, __ _shared, and that means that the data is actually going to reside on the GPU chip in the on-chip parallel cache called shared memory. Okay, you can declare the data so that it will be residing on-chip. So now you can see that there are explicitly allocated kind of memory. John, you have a smile on your face. Okay, that you can actually control some of these things. So these keywords are really used for you to designate, where things go, okay, and how they can be accessed, okay. There are not a lot of syntax that you need to write, so that's okay. But on the other hand, every keyword you use have some major effects that you need to be aware of, okay. You have some of these built-in variables that are kind of used as reserved keywords, such as thread IDX, index. And block index. It's the thread IDX and block IDX. These things are pre-initialized variables, okay? And these variables actually contain the identification of the thread, of the particular thread that is being executed. Remember, this is a single program, multiple data model. So there will be a huge number of threads all executing the same function, right? So the way for them to do different things and know what they need to do, it comes from their own ID. It's like essentially their social security number. So the program logic is going to say, if your thread ID is this, go do this, right? If your thread ID is that, go do that. So you're going to see that kind of, you know, arrangement. So you can access a data structure using your thread ID. That means every thread will be accessing a different part of the data structure. Okay? Intrinsics. There will be intrinsic functions, and the most important one is sync thread. This is a barrier synchronization. So if you place a sync thread in the middle of your code, then all the threads within a block, and I'm gonna introduce that, but a group of threads will all essentially be waiting for each other at a barrier synchronization until everyone has come in, and then everyone will go out together. Okay, and this is the primary synchronization mechanism in CUDA. You know, it doesn't have some of the more sophisticated, consumer producer kind of synchronization, but this kind of synchronization is extremely useful when you have a massive amount of parallelism and you need to just make sure that all the data elements in one particular group have been handled before you go to the next phase. There's a runtime API, and essentially you're going to have library functions that allow you to allocate CPU memory and GPU memory or device memory, and you can transfer data back and forth between those memories. And you can have mechanisms that allow you to actually enter the parallel execution called kernel match. So you can actually call your kernel with an additional syntax with three less than signs, and then you have a few numbers or a few kind of a few structs that will give you the organization of the thread blocks and the number of threads in the blocks. And then you have the regular function parameter. So invoking parallel execution in CUDA is essentially a function call. And the function call will typically get some parameters. So you will still see those parameters. But before you see the parameters, it also specifies how many threads you're going to use to execute this function. And that's where you start to execute in parallel.
Now,
the way the tools are built is that you will be writing your code as a single program. So essentially, you can take a C program that you currently have, and you can add in those, you can add in those keywords all over the place, and then you can transform some of your, time-consuming, data-intensive functions into kernel functions, right? And after you're done with that, you can run that program through the CUDA C compiler. And this C compiler actually does two things. It will take the kernel function and essentially feed it into the NVIDIA, a GPU compiler, and it will generate, all these things that are going to be executed on the GPU. It also will clean up the code and, make all kinds of arrangements, and so send the rest of the code into the host CPU compiler. So it does not really go into the compilation of your CPU code. It actually feeds that code into your original C compiler. And this allows them to focus on the pre-processing of those additional keywords and so on, and then focus on the high-quality code generator on the device, while avoiding a lot of the legacy code issues and so on that a GCC or a host compiler need to maintain. They essentially use the original compilers to handle a lot of the legacy code issues. So this essentially allows you to have more reliable tool chain and maintain your original usage of applications. So let's go into the threads. Okay, and the threads on slide 14 The picture is really the sort of the most basic sort of concept behind the CUDA threads. So the CUDA kernel code function, the CUDA function will be executed by many, many threads, and they're organized into arrays. So you essentially you can refer to these threads as thread array elements. Okay, you can index them, you can identify them with these indices. So every thread has an ID called thread ID, and it's actually spelled as thread IDX. And so conceptually, what you have here is you can actually take input. Let's say you have a large input array, and you can use that thread ID to identify the particular element or elements that you want to access as input. Okay, so you know what? Then so you can pass in a very large array and then let the thread ID to go, for each thread to go to the right part and get the input data. And then you can do some kind of computation, and or you can even access data in the middle of the function. And eventually you use your thread ID to determine where you're going to write into the output array. So this little function picture shows that we have 8 of these threads, and they're going to be indexed from 0 to 7, and then you can just use the thread ID to access these elements in the in these input and output arrays. But it turns out that there are actually 2 levels of hierarchy in terms of the thread organization. You actually will have a bunch of threads that will form a thread block. So essentially, up to 512 threads can be organized into a block. Okay, and then you will have multiple blocks. And these multiple blocks will also have their own ID. So you will have block 0, block, there's a type of thread block 1, and then eventually thread block N minus 1. And in the execution, you will also be able to use the block ID to access your data structures. So the combination of a block ID and thread ID will eventually give you the right information about where you need to go. So this is not new, right? In any of these organizations, let's say we do this all the time. We have these street addresses, right? And then we have the street names. So naturally that's a 2-level hierarchy. In order for you to find a place, you need to know which street it is on. So that's the block, right? And then you need to know the number on that street. That's the thread ID. Right. So in many ways, this is this is nothing new. There are some organizational support that can make things a little bit easier. Yes.
So how does block relate to the architecture? What does block consist? Like memory or everything?
Okay. So the question is, how does the block correspond to the architecture? And that's a great question. So let me give you a quick answer, but we're going to actually see this several times. The quick answer is these blocks are actually the unit of assignment of these threads into the hardware. So every time the hardware sends thread for execution into one of the SMPs, it's sent on a block by block basis. The entire blocks are shipped. Okay. So each thread can use ID to decide, to decide which data to work on, and the thread ID can actually be organized into 1 dimension, 2 dimensions, or 3 dimensions. Okay, it's up to you to organize the up to 512 threads. You can organize them all of them into a single dimension, okay, or you can organize them into 2 dimensions. You can have something like a 16 by 32 a 2-dimensional organization together, 512 total. Or you can even have 3 dimensions. You can have 4 by 4 by 32, and that will also give you 512. Internally, they all get eventually, you know, converted into a single index eventually. But this allows you at the primer level to be able to use things into one dimension, two dimension, three dimension according to the needs of your application. So you can produce these cubes or, you know, squares or rectangles and so on, or threads that match your data structure. Okay. The blocks can be organized into either one dimension or two dimensions. And you can have a huge number of blocks. Okay. You can have up to 64,000 per dimension, right, in the two-dimensional grid.
I think it's 64K minus one.
Okay, minus one. And then the thing, actually, that's from 0 to 64K minus one, so that is 64K. Anyway.
No, I think it's actually 64K minus one.
Okay, John is right. You know, you're going to see this again and again. You know what? So what happens is that, I think in the future, the block ID could also increase to three dimensions. But, up to this generation, it's still two dimensions. And these dimensions help you to simplify memory accesses, because they can naturally fit into these multi-dimensional data structures that you need to handle for these applications. So let's kind of go into So that's the basic concepts behind the threads. And now let's go into the memory model. Okay. There is, as I mentioned, there is a global memory. The global memory is really the main device memory. The reason why it's called global memory is because this is also the memory that will be easily accessible by the CPU. When the CPU is going to transfer data from the CPU memory into the device, this is going to be, the main mechanism for communication. Another reason why it's called global memory is because this is the memory that is going to be visible, accessible by all the SMPs and all the threads. So every thread will be able to have visibility into that global memory. Okay, and it's a very long latency access. How long? Nobody knows. Okay, but you can safely assume that it's going to be hundreds of clock cycles. If you ever access global memory, it's going to take hundreds of clock cycles. So you better be prepared to be able to do something else when you access a global memory. And that's the fundamental reason why they use so many threads. They want to make sure that there's always something accessing memory, but there's something else that is doing something useful within the GPU. Yes.
Where is the difficult to measure
the latency? It's not
difficult.
It's not difficult to measure the actual latency, but the memory latency actually is load dependent. So it depends on how many on flight and all that stuff. So that's why I said nobody knows. Any supplement?
The difficulty is that it's impossible to measure the latency of one load when you have thousands upon thousands of outstanding loads. And the scheduling of these loads to the memory is more or less arbitrary. So your particular load could take a seemingly infinite amount of time because if it just happens
to be one. If you're once with bad luck.
Yeah. So.
Okay. Yes.
So where does global memory actually exist on the hardware?
They are implemented in terms of graphics DRAM, GDDR.
Okay.
So that's the 1 gig to 4 gig.
Okay. So
it's
not the VMA
window. Okay. Good. So by the way, I don't. Some of these questions may or may not make sense to individuals. And don't panic, don't worry, okay? You all come in with different expertise and so on. That I will answer most of these questions, but you're not going to really unless I say explicitly, you are not going to really have to worry about it as far as the programming is concerned, as far as the exams are concerned. Okay. So you will, time will come when some of your expertise will make everyone else panic. So you know what? We will focus on the global memory for now, in the sense that there are really two more things that I'm not showing on the picture in the global memory sort of space. One is constant memory, one is texture memory. And these things are also accessible by the CPU. They're also visible by the all the threads. But we're not going to worry about those until we start to look into some of these performance programming issues.
Okay. So
let's start with some API functions that you're going to be using from day one. And these APIs are really extension to the NCC programming language, essentially the C runtime library. Okay. So that's why you will invariably find a lot of these parallels or analogies between the CUDA API and the original C library. Okay. They're just oftentimes just some subtle differences added so that you can do the additional functionality. And the hardware is designed to enable very lightweight runtime drive driver for high performance. So that's why a lot of these when you measure some of you will actually go and measure the data transfer rate and the runtime API invocation overhead, and most of you will pleasantly be surprised how little overhead these things are, because there's actually a lot of hardware support underneath it to make sure that these APIs function calls are low latency, and then they can achieve very high data transfer rate and so on. So the first API function that you'll be using is CUDA malloc. For those of you who have done C programming, memory allocation, right? This is just malloc kind of concept. So it's very similar. But this CUDA malloc allows you to allocate memory, in a global space. And so essentially, it requires two parameters. One is a pointer to the allocated object, okay? And so this is essentially, what's going to be returned to you. And the other one is the size of the allocated object. This is from you. You're going to tell the runtime, I need so many bytes, right? And the function is going to come back and return a pointer to those bytes in the global memory. So it's not all that different from the C malloc interface. CUDA free, you need to free your objects. So basically all you need to do is to just pass the pointer to the object that you're going to free from the global memory. Okay, make sure you free them. Okay, and memory leak is not fun when you only have a few gigabytes. And it's funny that I say that. When I say that memory leak is not fun when you have only a few gigabytes, I still remember when I first started here to teach, I'm not going to tell you how many years ago, it's kind of a little bit sentimental. So several years ago, when I started teaching here, I had two grad students. And when I started, and they came to my office once and said, this is a very bad situation, we really need to improve the situation, da 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 da. And I finally said, okay, tell me exactly what's the situation. And I say, our file system quota is very, very bad. They only allow us to access store 4 megabytes in our file system. Okay, you imagine, right? You can only have up to 4 megabytes in your Unix file system, right? And we're talking about up to 4 gigabytes of main memory, right? So time has come. So you can almost just tell when I started teaching here by
doing those numbers in your head, right? Okay.
So the allocation is fairly simple, but you know, there are a couple of things that you need to pay attention to. One is, you know, typically you will need to allocate, you know, typically what you have in mind is the number of data elements or the size of your data array, right? The number of elements in your data array. So typically what you would do is, if you want to have a 64 by 64, let's say single precision floating point array allocated, right, two dimensional 64 by 64 array, then you can declare something like, you know, a width of 64, and then you can do the multiplication to get a 64 by 64, but then you will want to use size of float. And this will give you portable code, because you can easily change your type, or, you know, in the future, if float gets changed into double precision by default, you will automatically get your code upgraded, right? So then once you calculate the size, you can pass that size into the CUDA analog, and then you pass a pre-declared pointer, which is the float pointer in your code. So you can use pass this pointer, a pointer to that pointer into the code, and then eventually the function will return with the address deposited right into this pointer. So that's why you're passing the ampersand of the pointer, so that the function can actually write the address into that pointer. Then in the end, you would just pass the pointer to the free and then just free object.
Okay. So it's not all that complex.
Once you allocated your data into global memory, you can now transfer data. Transfer data from CPU into the data into the global memory, and the way to do this is memcopy. Okay, this is again very similar to the C memcopy routine, but it's extended with CUDA here, and it requires four parameters to the transfer. The first one is a pointer to the destination. Okay, the second one is pointer to the source, and the third one is the number of bytes you need to copy. Okay. And the fourth one is the type of transfer, essentially direction. You can transfer from host to the device. You can transfer from device back to the source, okay? And then you can transfer from device to device and from source to source, from the host to host.
You have the operations, serve X or pressure.
Yeah.
Like, how is the memory space of your copy? How is the address space of the GPU related to the address space of the host?
Okay, let me take a simple shot, because we're going to come back to that point. The simple thing is they're separate. So the pointer that you get when you call that malloc is actually an address in the GPU space. It has no meaning, direct meaning in the CPU space. So all you really should do with that pointer in the CPU code is to pass it quickly into the CUDA copy. If you try to dereference that pointer, you get all kinds of bad things. Okay, do not do that. Okay, so you have a little bit of a kind of a glimpse into the GPU space with that pointer, but really what you should do is you just pass that pointer to some of these functions. Make sense?
Yeah.
Okay, so you know what? It's an asynchronous transfer, meaning that when you launch that data transfer, it's not going to be blocking, so you can continue to do some other things while it's transferring data. Okay.
For those of you that are more familiar with the semantics of MPI programming, it's technically a non-blocking transfer, not an asynchronous transfer. So it is a synchronous transfer, but the API function is non-blocking.
Okay, makes sense? Okay.
Now, so let's do a very quick code example. If you want to transfer a 64 by 64 single precision floating point array from the CPU to the GPU, then let's say M is a piece of data that you declare in the CPU memory space, right? And let's say MD is a data that you declare in the device memory space. And you know what, so now these are the, these are the pointers to those two spaces, right? And this will be initialized by that CUDA malloc, right? So now you have these constants. These are the predefined constants in the CUDA sort of the language, and you can say CUDA main copy host to device, and this actually just is a constant definition with a low-level constant, you know, you can look up from the header file. But this gives you a much more logical way of specifying the direction rather than a simple number that in 2 days you're going to forget which way it is, right? So you can do a main copy from host and, right? The first one is destination, so it will be from host to the device, specified by the size, and the direction is memory copy from host to device. So when you call this function, you will be transferring the contents of M from the CPU to the contents of MD on the GPU. Okay? And at the end of the computation, if you want to transfer the data back, you can just reverse these two, you do a different order, you do a different constant, it goes to the GPU. So you need to be careful because some of these things are the GPU and some of these are CPU pointers. If you give the wrong constant, bad things can happen. Okay? So that's why you need to be careful with these things. So this is going to be recurring theme in some of our lectures. You know, the kind of things that you're learning here now is fairly low level, you know what? So you can actually do things to hurt yourself. And you need to be careful. On the other hand, you have a lot of control over what's being done. And you know what? So you need to, you know, appreciate the fact that you do have the control, but you can also shoot yourself in the foot very easily. So let's go a little bit more into the CUDA function declarations. You know what? Let's say you start with a C function, a C program with all kinds of functions, right? So you have main function, and you have all these functions that can be called, and the functions that can call others. So you can start with that model. And when you convert that code into a CUDA code, you need to have a way for the parallelism execution to start. And as I mentioned before, that's the kernel function. So you can convert some of the functions into kernel functions by doing the following. You can actually call it global. You can put __ global followed by __ in front of that function declaration. The reason why it's a global function is because the function now will be, you know, executed, will be available to all the threads, and also it's visible by the CPU. The CPU can call this function, okay? The CPU code will eventually call this function to start the parallel execution. There are also other, other keywords. __ host. Essentially, you are saying that the host code is going, this function is going to be on host. And you say, that's weird. You know, you start with the original code, right? Why do you have to bother to relabel all the functions into host code, right? The answer is you don't have to. If you don't say anything, it's going to default into host. Okay, so this means that you don't need to mess with a lot of the original code that you're not converting into parallel. If you label a function as device, that function is going to be only available on the device. That is, it becomes a GPU execution function. It cannot be called from the host. Okay? Now, if you have a function that you want to be able to have both on the host and the GPU, you can feel free to have __ device and what? __ host. So this is the real reason why you need to have that host keyword. Because you want to make, if you want to make sure that you, a piece of function gets created for both GPU and the CPU when you do the migration, you want to make sure you still have a CPU version. That's where you add a global keyword. The host keyword. Does that make sense? So we are right at 10 till. So this is where we're going to pick up next time. So next time on Tuesday, essentially what I'm going to do is I'm going to take you through an entire code example and put all these things to use. so that you see exactly how to write that first piece of code.
Okay. See you next Tuesday.